Question and response, the role of state government. We intend to spend the next hour and a half or so discussing various proposals to stimulate Oregon's economy and create jobs. The proposals from the Governor's Economic Advisory Group, the Oregon FL-CIO, and AOI, the Senate's Special Committee on Economic and Job Stimulus, and the proposal Governor Kitzhaber made last week. We have copies of those apparently available on the table, if you're able to get to one of those. Here to discuss the proposals are two panelists. First, Professor Anthony Ruffalo from Portland State University School of Urban Studies and Planning, and Dr. Ruffalo has a doctorate in economics from UCLA. And also we have Jeff Thompson, a policy analyst and economist from the Oregon Center for Public Policy. Mr. Thompson has a master's degree in economics from the New School of Social Research in New York City. And I also want to reintroduce our interim House of Business and Commerce Committee members. We have Representative Carlson as vice chair, and Representative Merkley, and Representative Donna Nelson on the end. And our left or right side, depending on your view, is not here currently. So I'm going to reconvene our committee meeting from earlier today. Our panelists will be discussing answers to questions from the audience. If you'd like to ask a question, we have paper for those questions, and you can write those questions on the paper, and we'll pick them up and we'll ask them of the panelists. We may not get to everyone, although my guess is that we probably will. And a few more guidelines that we're going to try to adhere to. We will attempt to confine discussion to the economic aspects of the specific economic stimulus proposals, their specific costs and benefits, if any. And we will try to avoid a discussion of general budget cutting and budget reductions, whether or not the proposed budget cuts amount to smaller increases rather than cuts, or if they're just cuts. And we'll try to avoid discussion of proposed tax and fee increases and the wisdom of tapping into current funds like the tobacco settlement. And we'll try to confine our debates or our forum to just those issues that have been proposed in terms of economic stimulus. And we will try to avoid a scene such as the fisticuffs at the recent heavyweight boxers news conference. I'm sure all the committee members will cooperate. And I think we're ready to start. So Professor Ruffalo, why don't you lead us off, and then Mr. Thompson, you can give your remarks after him, and then we'll get right to it.
Thank you. Basically, I guess my role here is as the naysayer. I think if you look at government's ability to combat recession, you'll find that the state level the levers that are available to the state are limited and are generally not very effective. To begin, I think the first thing to think about is, when did this recession begin? And if you look at the timing that officially comes from NBER, it began on March 1st. I would be willing to gamble that not many people in the legislature back in March or April or May or June were aware that we were entering into a recession, or were planning on what to do in response to that recession. Given the time lag and simply knowing what the current status of the economy is, coupled with the time lag for the legislature to take action, and then the time lag associated with implementation, we typically would find that government is not capable of timing any activity to deal with the recession in any meaningful manner. In fact, during the 1970s, the federal government actually had a program where they would encourage states to take capital projects and, in effect, put them on the shelf for funding to be implemented during a recession as a countercyclical policy. The RAND Institute did an analysis of this program and found that almost invariably the stimulus occurred more at the peak of the business cycle than during the recession, that even though the projects were pre-screened and ready to go, the lag in terms of identifying that we were in a recession, actually then implementing the policy that was in place and getting the programs underway was sufficiently long that they really had virtually no impact on as a countercyclical policy. When you add to that the fact that the state government is pretty much constrained by a balanced budget requirement. There are very few levers that are available that would be very meaningful in terms of its ability to counter the ordinary business cycle. I think, for example, this hearing is being held today, and yet those of you who have been listening to the news may be aware that the Fed chose not to take any action today, and that basically the information coming from their analysis is that we've probably already turned the corner and started into recovery. There are some numbers that came out about some of the growth numbers that were much more optimistic than the analyses had predicted. So I'm not saying that we necessarily have turned the corner, but I think the uncertainty about that, the question of when we know that we are actually, you know, in an upswing, and how long it would take to implement any countercyclical policies, all argue that we're not likely to be very effective in timing, and that the amount of impact that we're likely to have would be small. I guess we've also been asked to look at some of the specific proposals that are here, and I just wanted to quickly go through the governor's proposal and some of the ones that have come out from some of the other groups. The first one, you know, passed the Oregon Transportation Investment Act of 2002. Clearly, one of the things that a state can do is use bonding authority to move activities into the present that otherwise would have occurred in the future. To the extent that this is a proposal to use bonding authority to basically spend money now when the economy is in recession as opposed to in the future, if it could be implemented quickly, then it certainly, you know, it certainly is a reasonable item. It also comes up as high priority under the Economic Strategy Advisory Group recommendations to increase the bonding authority that's already been authorized because of that they should be able to borrow more because of lower interest rates. Again, those are reasonable policies, and I think the problem I see with the proposal that the governor has is that he's also proposing to raise taxes. And the $15 per year auto registration fee increase is likely to be unconstitutional, since we do have a constitutional requirement that the funding for roads and road improvements be apportioned according to cost responsibility between heavy and light vehicles. And this is a proposal to only increase the fee for light vehicles. I don't know how that would work out. I certainly don't pretend to be a constitutional lawyer, but it does seem to violate the intent of the constitutional amendment that was passed by the voters a couple of years ago. And it's also not clear to me why you need additional funding in order to be able to issue bonds. It would seem to me that you could take any of your existing revenue sources and devote those to bonds and do that without going through the necessity of getting a tax or fee increase approved. Pass the lottery bond authorization bill. I think that's a very poor idea. I understand the intent, but I think that one of the things that you need to be careful of is to have good public policy when you're looking at these things and not throw away good public policy in order to potentially fight the recession. The problem that I see with this is that we're looking at general obligation bonds as opposed to lottery-funded bonds. And the intent here is to say that, well, gee, we know the lottery is going to provide the funding, but clearly if that were true, there wouldn't be any problem in floating the bonds in the first place. And the state has run into problems in the past in using general obligation authority to fund bonds for specific purposes. The specific instance I'm thinking of is the Veterans Home Loan Program, which is supposed to be self-supporting, but which almost became a major drag on the state budget. I think it was about 10 years ago when the general obligation authorization was almost implemented because of losses in that program. So I think that the lottery bond authorization bill creates similar problems. I mean, yes, as long as the lottery is going to be okay and the revenue is going to be there, then this is not necessarily going to become an obligation of the state. But you are promising state general obligation, and I think that would be a poor policy in this case. And I would, you know, for that reason, I think that this is not necessarily a good policy. Authorize $3 million in additional strategic reserve fund. Again, I've done a lot of analysis of economic development programs, and generally the conclusion that comes out of the academic literature is that they are not very effective, that there is virtually no evidence that they really do create net job increases. There are certain instances where they can help depressed areas and move jobs around within a state, but there's virtually no evidence that any of these programs actually lead to net increases in employment within a state. I would argue that if this has been such a great program and economic development has been doing such a great job, why do we currently have the highest unemployment rate in the country? So I'm not sure why we would think that this is going to be a very effective use of funds. And I certainly don't think that there is an awful lot of evidence that government is particularly adept at picking the appropriate places to the appropriate businesses to expand and the people to be subsidized by these activities. The school stabilization fund. I've been arguing for many, many years that we need a rainy day fund. I don't see, however, why you would want to start the rainy day fund in the middle of the recession. It would seem to me that, yes, a rainy day fund is an excellent idea, but now is not the time to start it. Now would be the time that you'd want to be drawing upon it. This should have been started in the past, or it should be started during the next recovery when there are resources that are available. Right now, it seems to me that this would be exactly the opposite of what you would want to do, which is, in effect, raising taxes to put money aside for a rainy day. And why would you want to do that when you've identified yourself as being in a recession? Just briefly on the other remaining items, the AFL-CIO proposals, I didn't go into that in detail, but I think in a certain sense, we can view the unemployment compensation fund as being a form of rainy day fund. I mean, the intent there is to cushion the impact of job loss on workers, and to the extent that you're not changing policy, but simply using the fund in the manner in which it was intended, I think there are probably something positive to be said for using those funds as they were intended to assist workers. I don't know about the details of any of the proposals. Certainly some of them seem to be changes in policy. To the extent that they're good policy, then they're probably worth doing. But again, using some of the surplus or the balance of the fund, I'm not sure I would want to call it surplus, some of the balance of the fund for its intended purpose, which is to cushion the impact of unemployment, it would seem to me that that is really the type of rainy day fund that is appropriately tapped during a recession, and that would be good public policy. I think that's about it with respect to my remarks on these specific proposals.
Thank you, Professor. Mr. Thompson?
All right. Even though many of my conclusions will mirror those that Professor Ruffalo just covered, I'll go ahead and go through my spiel anyway. As the members of this committee know, Oregon is currently considered to be in a recession, unemployment rate hitting 7.5%, the highest in the country. 130,000 unemployed Oregonians and 37,000 jobs lost relative to a year ago. Fairly well spread across different industrial sectors, although finance, insurance, and real estate being spared, as well as government sector, durable manufacturing and construction being hit particularly hard. A couple of other factoids demonstrating our current situation. You can look to help want ads as being an indicator of the decline in the demand for labor. The Oregonian, their help want ad count is down 54% from a year ago. The Register Guard down 40% from a year ago, and the Bend Bulletin similarly down 32%. Clearly, employers not looking for nearly as many workers as they were this time even 1 year ago. Unemployment rate reaching 7.5%, and brief historical looking in a rearview mirror, it roughly hitting the levels of the high points of the previous recession of the early 90s, which was not, I don't think, considered a very severe recession, but remaining well below levels achieved, if I can put it that way, in the early 80s and the recession in the mid 70s, which unemployment reached 11% and 12% in those two recessions. And of course, Oregon's economy is not the only economy in recession. Oregon does not exist in an economic vacuum. The U.S. economy entered recession in March 2001. U.S. GDP declined by 1.3% in the third quarter of 2001. The news this morning suggests that the preliminary results for GDP for the fourth quarter of 2001 maybe growth, preliminary figures, but 0.2% real GDP growth in the fourth quarter, fueled largely by auto sales, spurred by 0% financing. And that clearly impacts the GDP figures. Will those impact last? I don't think people are expecting that car sales are going to continue to fuel GDP growth like they did in the fourth quarter, but the future is obviously uncertain. However, the projection that is, I think, currently embodied in the state's December economic and revenue forecast, and I think appears in a number of other forecasts of when the economy is going to recover. If it's not happening now, I think the general forecast is that we will return to, as a country, positive GDP growth by the second quarter of 2002, so mid-2002, roughly. And obviously that has implications regarding timing of what the state can do. And I'm going to shift now into talking about some general rules of thumb. But I will say that stimulus, obviously, thinking about economic stimulus policy obviously is connected directly to the fact that the U.S. and more specifically for this conversation, Oregon, is in a recession. But even after the country and the state leave recession, we can anticipate that slow growth will linger. We're going to return to positive growth, but growth rates will be slow, and it's expected as well that unemployment will lag at higher levels. We're not going to snap immediately back to the low levels of unemployment that we saw in the mid to late 90s. So high unemployment can be expected to linger in the early phases of the economic expansion. And that might be factored into. It doesn't have to. That doesn't obviously predetermine how you're going to respond with your economic stimulus policy, but that could be something that you would take into consideration. Regarding what state government can or should do about the recession that we're currently in, I think in general, Professor Ruffalo's observations that there's limited capacity for Oregon to do much about the situation that we're in. We have a balanced budget amendment, so we can't run deficits to stimulate this economy in general by borrowing. We also are being impacted by economic forces external to us. Our sectors that rely on exports have been hit pretty hard. The monthly dollar value of Oregon's exports are down a quarter compared to a year ago. The MISER data coming out from the University of Massachusetts pegs the dollar value of exports from Oregon a year ago at $1 billion per month. Now, the most recent data for November shows that we're at $750 million per month, so we're roughly down a quarter in our exports. And there's not a whole lot we can do to drum up internal demand for those products that Oregon companies are producing and shipping overseas, especially when the economies that we trade with are also experiencing economic difficulties. St. Louis Federal Reserve Bank has put out a piece quite recently showing relative GDP growth in Europe and Japan and the U.S. Japan still, once again, in recession, and Europe, their growth rate falling nearly as fast as the U.S. in recent quarters. So there's a limited things that we can do, but I still think that it's worth kind of ticking off a list of general the general rules. First of all, is I think that to the extent possible, the state should not feed the cycle. The recession gets worse when people cut spending. The line is, the mill lays off workers, they stop spending on groceries. The grocery store lays off workers, and they stop spending elsewhere. And so it's a cycle. It's a reduction in demand cycle. People stop spending, and that act of ceasing spending feeds on itself. To the extent that the state can maintain its levels of spending during the recession, that will be a plus. There are obviously limits on the state's ability, primarily because we lack a rainy day fund, which we should have, and now is not the time to fund it, although now may be the time to create the vessel for it and create at a later date to start the process of funding the rainy day fund. And I think that there are, you know, it's a general discussion, and I think it's controversial, but it might be interesting to talk about. We can get into this issue of the discussion about, you know, the trade-offs, you know, at the state level in a recession, the relative merits of, you know, maintaining state spending through tax increases. But the final, a way to express I think the importance of the state maintaining its spending level in a recession, and one way to illustrate the stabilizing role that the state can play is that if you look at Oregon's current situation as of December, like I mentioned at the top, that we, compared to a year ago, we lost 37,000 jobs and the unemployment rate 7.5%. But the state actually grew slightly. The state government, not just the state, but federal, state, and local government, mostly fueled by local, there was slight growth. It grew over a year ago, grew a little more than 1%. However, if the state had declined along with the rest of the economy, so it followed a similar trend, job losses would be about 10,000 higher. Our unemployment rate would be about a half point higher. So the degree that the state can maintain its levels of spending throughout the recession, I think, will have quite an important impact on the economy. Secondly, is to keep and, to the extent possible, augment our existing economic stabilizers. I mean, we do have a functioning unemployment insurance system, which is playing its proper role. I mean, one of the roles it's designed is to maintain and sustain workers who have been laid off through no fault of their own. And obviously, in a recession, unemployment, I think, is generally considered to be workers being laid off through no fault of their own. In December, there were 77,000 Oregonians receiving UI in the month. It's up 65% over a year ago, and that represents a substantial infusion of income into the state's economy. I mean, if we just think about the average weekly check of $250 roughly, and we kind of just average that across the month, of course not everyone receives all four checks in the month, but at 77,000 recipients, we're talking an infusion of $77 million each month into the economy. I think that's an important impact. Also, food stamps play an important role. In November, there were 340,000 Oregonians getting food stamps, up 38%, or 93,000 recipients from a year ago. And food stamps, other than the administrative cost, food stamps money is federal dollars. So these are important economic stabilizers. In fact, there's a recent study, economist Alan Auerbach looked at the relative effectiveness of UI spending as an economic stabilizer and found that it was, in fact, quite powerful. Both the tax system and the unemployment insurance system are both automatic stabilizers. When the economy goes into the tank, tax collections fall, unemployment insurance payouts rise. They both automatically respond. And while unemployment insurance spending is a tiny fraction of overall federal revenue, just between 1% and 3%, the stabilizing capacity of unemployment insurance was, according to Mr. Auerbach, was 1/4 of that of the entire tax system. So it has a powerful stabilizing effect. So we need to acknowledge that the role that this automatic stabilizer plays in our anti-recession policy. And additionally, even if we think that there's not a whole lot that the state can do, we're likely to be affected by stimulus policy from the federal level, for better or worse. So to the extent that the federal government is going to enact anti-recessionary stimulus policy that has a negative impact on Oregon, we might want to consider, to the degree that we can, counteracting that during the special session ahead of us. Just yesterday, press release came out announcing that Senator Smith had been successful in his quest to get the Senate to approve accelerated depreciation as well as an increase in the federal Medicaid match rate. So the Medicaid match rate rising by 3 percentage points is going to bring in a couple $100 million in additional funding to Oregon. That's a very good thing. But attached to that, the accelerated depreciation, that's going to have a cost to Oregon. think LRO estimated that it's in the 0103 biennium, expects to hit Oregon by $154 million revenue loss. And that is, if that indeed passes in the final form, the stimulus package, we're going to have to deal with that. And to the extent that this body is interested in considering the discussion of decoupling from the federal tax code to dodge that $154 million bullet, that might be discussed. And additionally, one of the comments that was relayed to the Senate Special Committee on Economic Job Stimulus final report, relayed by Ed Whitelaw, professor of economics at University of Oregon, as well as Eco Northwest, says, "Don't pick up any hitchhikers." And I think that that's an interesting way to put it. And some of the proposals in that document, I think, are hitchhikers with a mean look in their eye. And so, I would, as a further general principle, I would suggest that recession is a strange country, and we might not want to drink the snake oil, as it were. I think that there is an important difference between short-term and long-term economic policy, and anti-recessionary economic policy is short-term policy. And to the degree that you're going to use the current recession to justify policy change, it essentially needs to be short-term. There are other policies that might be good policies, but in general, they should be considered and passed, justified on their, without reference particularly to our current economic situation. Brief quote from a professor at the University of, I believe, Michigan, former economist and President Reagan's Council of Economic Advisors, Joel Slemrod. Mr. Slemrod says that politicians love to promise more and better jobs for voters, and so do advocates of tax reform. Aside from the natural tendency of interested parties to exaggerate, do such claims about jobs have any economic content? In a word, no. And so I believe that Mr. Slemrod has a point that is echoed in a lot of the economic literature. There's just not as much, there's not very much support for claims that proposals to cut taxes are dressed up in. And even though I don't think that there's many, tax cutting is not on the table with regards to economic stimulus in general, a lot of the suggestions in the final report were not only dealing with long-term policy issues, but we're also focusing on tax cuts, which I think many of them would not be wise policy. Make a brief comment touching on several of the specific proposals. First of all, the AFL-CIO's UI expansion proposals, basically similar feelings as Professor Ruffalo, in that this is a policy. I mean, the UI program is serving its intended anti-recessionary economic stabilization role, and some of these components are good ideas. The degree to which permanent changes to the UI system are justified under recession as anti-recessionary policy, is debatable on some of these issues. Some of them may be good policy changes in their own right, which should be considered. A recent report was put out this morning, put out yesterday rather, by the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, drawing attention to unemployment insurance exhaustion rates. So in the fourth quarter of 2001, the number of UI recipients in Oregon who had exhausted their UI benefits was over 16,000, so an increase of nearly 100% from a year ago. So the specific component that proposes to extend UI benefits to beyond the 13-week extension is something that should be considered, I think, given our current situation with high exhaustion rates. And I think that specifically with regard to thinking that money is going to be coming down the pike, potentially in federal economic stimulus. And if that money is not channeled into, essentially, if changes in the current UI program are not made, that money might actually trigger a reduction in the UI fund and not actually get into the hands of unemployment, of potential future recipients of UI. I think that this, some of these changes to create policy change to bring more people onto UI at this particular point in time, I think could be a very good idea. Regarding the governor's proposal, specifically the infrastructure package, the $750 million infrastructure package, I think that some of these specific proposals, some of the specific infrastructure projects are probably quite needed. A year ago, the American Society of Civil Engineers did their 2001 report card, found 20% of Oregon bridges are structurally deficient or obsolete. There's a lot of building and repair that needs to be done in Oregon. How much of that is going to happen in time for the recession, I think, is very questionable, though. Peter Orzog and of the Brookings Institution gave federal testimony speaking to this issue of infrastructure spending and referred to research which showed that looking even in recent years at disaster funding appropriations, just 30% of those appropriations were spent in the first fiscal year following the enactment. 64% were spent the second year following the enactment, and the remainder were spent out in the third year following the enactment. So a considerable amount of this money is just not going to be spent anywhere close to the recession, so it can't really be justified as anti-recessionary, even though it might be good policy and even though it might be called for. And the governor's rainy day fund, I already said it, people have been calling for this for a long time. I think there's broad agreement that it's a good idea. It shouldn't be funded now. And funding it from lottery funds might not be an appropriate solution. We might think about modifying the formula, although it's a more difficult political road. I think about modifying the kicker formula to funnel general fund revenue coming in above forecast into a rainy day fund. And so I'll go ahead and close on that note.
Thank you, gentlemen. First, I would, even though your viewpoints are probably closer together than they are polar opposites, do you have any questions for each other?
I guess if you want to think of it as a question, Jeff said that, you know, that the state should be careful not to reduce public sector employment, and I guess my question would be, how would you fund that? Clearly, the one of the issues that we're facing is the need to keep the budget balanced. And if you insist on protecting jobs, then that means that, for example, you're talking about tax increases, which would be taking money away from people surviving through the recession, or that there would be other spending cuts. So if you're going to protect all jobs, I guess I'd ask how are you proposing to fund that?
Well, I think that the state is definitely, you know, given the fact that there is a balanced budget requirement in the Constitution, you can't get around the fact that there is the state is in a very tight position. And I think that probably I think raising the stabilizing role that state employment plays in the general economy, having said that, I don't think that the argument is necessarily that protecting state jobs is the goal. I think that the more general goal is to maintain spending levels. So I think the focus would be on maintaining aggregate demand. And so one route to pay for that is through tax increases. And on some level, you are talking a wash. I mean, on some level, you would be taking money from people who would otherwise be spending it, and you would be spending it through the state. And I don't think that that's necessarily going to have any net impact in transactions. There may be maybe a decrease. However, if tax increases can be targeted towards those sources of money that are not currently being spent but saved, then you could be looking at net increase in terms of spending. And so those sources of spending would be the unspent discretionary revenues, or discretionary income, or disposable income, rather, of high-income households. So a tax increase targeted at high-income households could have a positive or at least a less negative impact than budget cuts in our current recession.
Do you have any questions for the professor?
No.
Okay. Committee members, you may have questions, so I'll open it up to you. We've got a couple here from audience members, but we'll get to those in a second. Representative Nelson?
Sure. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
You may want to use your mic just so...
I can cough a little more right directly in it. I do want to apologize for that. I'm not contagious, so I really do apologize. I'm on an antibiotic. And thank you. Do you say Ruffalo, Doctor?
Ruffalo.
Ruffalo. Yeah. Ruffalo. And Jeff. Dr. Ruffalo and Jeff, thank you very much for being here. Before we talk about maintaining spending or you changed it to aggregate demand. I kind of like that term. I'm going to use that, and I think I'm so smart when I get home to my district. But as economists, how many times do you think, money changes hands in a community? You know, I remember many times going to, you know, build new businesses and, you know, in Terre Haute, Indiana, for example, to set up the USPS postal hub, aviation hub, you know. So we, to sell it to the community, we said, you realize all these dollars are going to change hands, you know, 4 to 8 times, depending on whether you're talking to Milton Friedman or, you know, some other economist. What is your opinion?
I'm not sure exactly what your question is. I mean,
well, we're talking about maintaining spending, so those dollars continue to turn over and turn over in the community. So what is the turnover rate?
Well, the turnover rate certainly depends upon how the money is spent. For example, while certainly if you employ someone, they're going to purchase groceries, they may also purchase a television that was produced outside of the state. So the exact impact of that will depend upon the nature of the industry, the occupational mix of the people that the money is spent on, how the purchasing of the particular business works, and so on. I mean, I don't think there's a general answer to your question.
Okay, would you agree, Mr. Chair? Excuse me, Jeff, would you agree with that answer?
I think that's right. I think that's basically right. I have seen figures, and this is a slightly different concept, not necessarily money changing hands, but related
what figures
to what
have you seen?
Well, related to what you're talking about, I mean, there's the issue of the multiplier.
Right.
So an infusion of cash can have a larger impact. And I've seen figures of 1.5, but these, like Professor Ruffalo noted, I mean, change on over time. At different points in time, the multiplier will be different. They're different for different industries. I've seen multiplier figures of 1.5.
Follow up, please, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
I thought we did just super worrying about our business community in the last session and passed the capital gains tax relief plan, and it got vetoed. Perhaps you could explain how you feel about the benefits of credits versus other means of stimuli, tax credits, when it comes to boosting the economy.
Well, my general view on that, I think I would agree with Jeff. The first question is it good public policy? And I think certainly you would want to look at what your expectations are in terms of the overall economy if you're making major changes in the tax code. On the other hand, if you're looking at the question of stimulating the economy in the short run, one of the things that you can try to do is to encourage businesses to increase some of their investment expenditures and move them from the future into the present, which possibly could be accomplished with credits. Again, I think the issue of timing is a very important one as to whether it would actually be implemented in time in order to accomplish that. The notion that you were talking about earlier of the multiplier assumes that this is fresh expenditure that otherwise would not have occurred within the state. And one way that can happen is through investment expenses. Again, you need to be very cautious in terms of the estimates that come out of that. People tend to exaggerate them wildly, and I think you do need to be careful. On the other hand, there is, you know, a valid economic argument that if you can, in fact, increase the amount of expenditure. This sort of typically what's known as export expenditure, but investment also works in the same way. It can have a mild multiplier effect, and it can be stimulative. But again, I think the question of timing is a critical one here if you're looking at it in terms of the recession, and I think it's more important to maintain good public policy and, you know, and a good tax code as your overriding concern.
Thank you.
Representative Markley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Thompson, I just like you used a phrase, and I believe you were speaking about the governor's proposals when you said some of them resemble hitchhikers with a mean glint in their eyes. I thought it'd be interesting to find out which specific proposal you were referring to.
It's actually not referring to the governor's proposals, but rather a handful of the many, many, many comments that were listed in the final report document. It seems to me that I came away from reading this document as thinking that the vast majority of these proposals have essentially nothing to do with recessionary stimulus. I mean, most of them have to do with altering the big business climate for the long haul. And while I must say that I think many of them are I would not advise many of these policies, there's obviously nothing in here that shouldn't be on the table for discussion by the legislature, but it just shouldn't be anywhere near the discussion of what to do in response to the recession. So during the next regular session, in the discussions over how to modify the business climate, how to change, you know, Oregon's regulatory system, taxation system, some of these should be taken up. But I will say, you know, a couple that I have, you know, wrote down a few comments on are capital gains tax cuts. Representative Nelson just seemed to express some support for it, but at the time that this was being considered, we did some work pointing out some of the shortfalls of that specific proposal, and as well as a policy that was partially implemented. There was a single sales factor legislation that was enacted. It wasn't fully enacted. The final version was super sales, I guess 80% weighting. And this is essentially the full version of that specific bill would have, you know, altered the rules for how to corporate taxation rules, so they would only focus on the amount of sales that a company has in Oregon. And legislative revenue expected that this bill would cost $100 million per biennium. And one of the lobbyists working on behalf of this bill testified that this particular policy change could truly be one of the most significant statewide economic development or employment generators Oregon has witnessed for some time. LRO, round the numbers, $100 million price tag, 100 jobs per year. It was $50 million per year at 100 jobs, so $500,000 per job. I hope we can do a heck of a lot better in terms of public policy and tax policy than that. So those particular are two that I would apply that particular phrase to.
Representative Carlson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I'm trying to get these down because as we spoke now, I have two more questions. The governor, when he did his press conference, his initial press conference around the all cuts budget, had a diagram, and I don't know if you had an opportunity to see that press conference or any of the materials, but he essentially condensed the debate into three alternatives. One was an all-cuts budget, the second was short-term revenues to plug the gap, and the third was long-term revenue solutions to plug the gap. And as legislators and the governor have done different iterations of their budget, it really didn't come down to three discrete alternatives, but more a combination of some cuts, some short-term revenues, and some long-range revenue solutions, depending on who's providing the different options. Given the economic principles that you've laid out, do you have thoughts in terms of where that balance might lie? But we've heard some comments on budget cuts. We've heard some comments on short-term and some on long-term. Where would you weight it? What would be the appropriate mix in the immediate special session environment that we have right now?
Well, I'm not sure that there's a general answer to that. I think the first thing I would point out is that there's, you know, that we really did have a large increase in funding over the previous biennium, and that certainly that money has gone somewhere. And I think that looking at where the money has, where the increases have gone, would be one of the first things to look at. The issue of, you know, of changing your tax code and raising revenues, I think is really one of long-term state policy. And I think that what you really need to do is address the longer-term implications of it, rather than looking at, you know, simply what the impacts are during the recession. I'm not sure that I can give you any easy answer as to how you would balance that and come up with the appropriate solution. But I do think that you need to be cautious about using the recession as an excuse to make major changes in either tax policy or spending policy. That really, the issue that you're facing right now is the short-term one of balancing the existing budget. But you don't want to do things that are also going to have major implications for future budgets and for the your ability to balance the budget or to set policy in the future. And I think, you know, the issue then becomes one of, okay, which types of tax taxes, for example, or revenue rates might be considered not long-term policy. And I think the answer to that is that there are very few, that most of the ones that you're going to look at would become, in effect, a long-term policy decision. And I think that those need additional scrutiny as opposed to, you know, to something that's saying we're just looking at what the impact of the recession is.
Second question? You mentioned, did you want to go ahead and respond to that?
Yeah, I mean, I would agree that there is no, I think, general rule as to where to draw the line. I will say that there are a couple of things that I think should be taken into account are the ability of state spending to draw federal spending. If you looked at the original, the all cuts budget, you know, tool submitted by the governor, that added up to at least $113 million in additional lost federal dollars. And so the degree to which you can hold on to spending that will also keep federal dollars, that will be a benefit to Oregon's economy. To some degree, that's an issue of composition, where to make the cuts, but it's also, I think, can be thought about in where the balance should be laid as to focusing more heavily on cuts versus tax increases. Although there's also an additional issue that I think should be paid attention to is, and I think that Professor Ruffalo is right, you can't just focus on, in terms of making serious tax policy changes, you can't enact serious tax policy changes with a mind to closing the current shortfall. I think we need to keep a mind for good policy in general, but also down the road. But I don't think that makes the task any easier. I mean, I think that I don't recall the figures I was looking for them, but the 03, 05, and 05, 07 preliminary estimates released as of December were both suggesting that those biennia were facing shortfalls as well. So the need for cuts and additional revenue, I think, is going to continue on after this session. And if slow growth lingers and if high unemployment lingers following a return to positive economic growth, we're still going to be facing these issues for some time.
Okay, thank you. Maybe I'll just tag on to that with a different second question, and that is, you mentioned around, you talked about Medicaid maps, this is Mr. Thompson, and food stamps, I guess it was the issue. We're talking about small administrative costs and bringing federal dollars in. Yesterday, I was on the Ways and Means Human Services Subcommittee, so I spent a lot of time looking at the human services budget during the session, and then they're going through a rebalance process, which will be in this building on Friday. One of the things that we heard yesterday in this rebalance discussion is that the food stamp is tied to the Oregon Health Plan in the sense that when people sign up for one, often they get the other. And so since much of the human services budget is caseload driven, even though it does have that federal funds piece attached to it, there's still a general fund match that is required, thus driving up spending as you drive up caseloads. And so you have this economic factor that we have right now, higher caseloads because of a poor economy. And then you latch on different services. Some of them may be primarily federally funded, but others require that general fund match. Given that, would you still advocate for the position that you took on the food stamps earlier?
Yeah, I would, and it undoubtedly is complicated by the dynamics that you discussed. Folks getting on food stamps find out about the existence of other programs and their eligibility for them, which does incur additional costs. But to turn away people from food stamps for that very reason would be doing two things. It would be essentially denying needy members of society basic sustenance at a time when they need it most, and it would be depriving the state of federal dollars, which are help aid growth in Oregon's economy. So I would say that obviously the totality of the funding issues around food stamps is not so simplistic as my initial comments suggested, but I still would think that it would be an important policy to continue to support food stamps.
I don't know, Dr. Ruffler, did you want to discuss that issue?
I don't think I have anything to add.
Okay. Let me just ask one more question. And that is, when you were responding to my first question, you talked a bit about tax increases and tax cuts, but we also have this issue whether we want to, for example, borrow from the Common School Fund, shift payment schedules in order to acquire some revenue short term. And it seems that given the lag time factor that you talked about, the fact that government responds later to things, that we have, in essence, our immediate issue of solving an immediate budget problem, and then we have next biennium's potential deficit, although that's a moving target. We don't know if the economy improves what that's going to look like. Is it possible to, in some way, segment the discussion in terms of let's look more at short-term revenues now, take some time to look at the long-term policy, because then the effect of that long-term policy, again, is going to be out even further if those decisions are made, say, June and July 2003 instead of February 8, 2002. So I guess I'm asking a timing issue in terms of making decisions around short-term revenues too, so that we don't diminish spending radically immediately, and how that would affect our discussion as we look at this whole budget issue.
I would be concerned that many of the things that are being discussed as short-term fixes really do have long-term implications, and I think that I agree with the governor's basic position, which is that you really don't want to be borrowing in effect in order to balance the budget right now if it's going to create additional problems for the next biennium. And I do think that you do need to address the structural effect of recession. It hasn't just lowered the revenues for this biennium, it has lowered the projected revenues for the next biennium. It's certainly true that the economy may come roaring back and that may change, but if you look at the way the forecasts generally work out and look at the rates of growth, it's not generally going to be the case that you're going to more than offset the impact of the recession for the next biennium. So the net result of that is that you really do have a problem for the next biennium as well, and that trying to solve this problem and ignore that, or at the expense of the future, just is going to make the problem a lot worse next time.
Thank you. I'm going to go through some audience questions. Professor, if a rainy day fund was created, what safeguards could be put in place to keep legislators from spending it on other programs?
Well, I think if it's created as a legislative program, I think it's very difficult, as we've clearly seen. As I indicated, you know, I've been in Oregon for 20 years now and have been advocating a rainy day fund, particularly after Measure 5, as being, you know, an absolute necessity, because the effect of that was to change our reliance to a very unstable source. I mean, if you rank tax sources, the personal income tax is the most unstable over time. And, you know, you really do, you know, need something to smooth that out over the business cycle. On the other hand, if you leave it up to the legislature and the governor, it seems that everything that's available gets spent. So I do think it would have to be a constitutional requirement that would, in fact, put some restrictions on how the money could be spent and when it could be spent. But other than that, I think there are lots of examples. I think something like 45 or 46 other states have rainy day funds, and they have managed to, maybe not maintain them at levels that would be considered to be most appropriate, but they have managed to maintain them without raiding them during periods of prosperity and so on. I think some of that becomes an issue of what the voters are expect and what they're willing to tolerate, as well as what the history has been. I think if you implement a rainy day fund today, there's going to be a lot of funds, a lot of pressure to spend it tomorrow. But the longer it's in place, the more it becomes a part of the institutional structure. But the other part of it, I think, would be a constitutional amendment with specific requirements for when the money could be spent. It would probably be the most direct way of ensuring that it doesn't get raided.
If I might add to that, I agree. I think placing in the Constitution and laying out specifically what the trigger mechanism is I think, quite a good idea. But I think and that clearly is designed to safeguard, to make sure that the fund is not spent irresponsibly or when it's not intended to be spent. But at the same time, I think there is a real danger from making the trigger too difficult to pull. And my reading of the requirements that are built into the governor's proposal that require both, I think he has a 3/5 in the legislature, as well as a vote of the people. I mean, that's a pretty, that could slow down the process of spending the money, which is a negative thing in and of itself, and it might be too difficult a hurdle to cross. Talking with people from research groups from different states, there's a lot of states where folks, they do have a rainy day funds, but they are not necessarily constructed all that wisely, the trigger mechanism being too difficult to pull, officials deciding, despite the fact that they're in a recession, that we're not going to spend the money, and I believe that Washington, D.C. does have a rainy day fund, but they didn't enact a provision that would allow them to stop putting money into it in the recession. So while they're spending money out of it, they're also pulling the money into it to fund it. I mean, that's a very bad idea. So you can make it too easy to spend, you can make it too hard to spend, and you know when to fund it and when to spend it, I think it should be paid a lot of attention to, but we absolutely need a rainy day fund.
So would you both support some sort of supermajority then to keep it from being too easy to tap by the legislature?
I think, you know, to the extent that you're going to have legislative decisions, yes, I think that's probably a good idea. But I think more importantly would be having guidelines as to when it would be appropriate to spend it and what percentages should be spent under what circumstances. I mean, you don't want a provision that says, you know, as soon as you go into any kind of recession, you spend the whole rainy day fund. Again, this notion of timing and projection. Right now, we're projecting that we're coming out of the recession. We could be wrong again. We could be going into an even deeper recession and have even more serious problems coming up. The difficult thing about a rainy day fund is to structure it in such a way that as you go into the recession, you may be able to tap it a little bit, but you don't completely use it up before you know that you're out of the recession and into the next recovery.
Legislative approval is going to be required. I think that layering that in addition to a vote of the people, probably one layer too many, but legislative approval I think should be required. But as to whether being 3/5, I think it would be, in terms of, I don't necessarily have a full grasp of the constitutional requirements about additional spending or, you know, how that, if a 3/5 would be required. But to the extent that a simple majority could meet the conditions, I don't think that would be an unreasonable trigger.
If we were to create a rainy day fund, how big should it be and why?
I think the usual guideline is about 5% of expenditures. I don't know that there's any firm number as to what is good and what is bad, but I think something in the order of 5 to 10% provides a comfortable cushion for our experience over most recessions. I think anything much less than 5% would probably not.
Basically agree. I mean, there is no firm number, but it definitely can be too small. I think the governor's pegged his proposal at 10% of general fund. I mean, what the current shortfall is, I mean, the 820 or figure is about 7% of the general fund. I mean, and not all that's going to be, according to his proposal anyway, his budget fix, only half of that. So, I mean, if you look at the 10% figure with regards to the situation that we're currently in, that probably could meet our needs. I think 10% is a reasonable figure.
Would lottery-backed bond projects be an economic stimulus if the Supreme Court makes a positive determination on the lottery and the state did not have a guarantee to repay from the general fund?
Again, if the projects could be implemented in the short term, then I think you know, the effect is the same as any other type of stimulus. It's you know, this notion of this exporting of activity. You're basically bringing an infusion of activity into the state, and yes, it would be an economic stimulus. I think, you know, again, even the notion of using some of the road fund to generate bonds, there's no reason why that couldn't be done. I think the key issue in terms of fighting the recession would be whether you could do it in a sufficiently short period of time to actually bring the projects online during the recession as opposed to bringing them online when we've moved well into recovery. Our experience with other government projects like this is that it's very difficult to get the timing like that. But in principle, yes, the answer to that question is yes.
So timeline meaning in the next, say, 2 to 4 months?
I think if you're looking at, you know, the most important impact with respect to the recession, yes. I mean, I think if you're looking at bringing them online a year from now, I think there's a substantial possibility that we'll be well into the recovery.
Mr. Thompson?
I wouldn't have anything to add. I mean, I think that, you know, hopefully a year from now we will be well into a recovery, and I think many of the forecasts suggest that. I mean, the degree to which high unemployment continues to linger, it may be a factor in terms of considering the employment impacts of these kind of proposals. But the longer the time lag is, the less relevant it's going to be regarding stimulating the economy.
This one is actually directed at Mr. Johnson. I believe that a reduction in tax rates and other tax cuts would keep the economy stimulated on a much more sustained rate, don't you?
Not necessarily. I mean, no. I mean, what in terms of macroeconomic spending and growth levels, government spending does matter, just as household spending matters in the economy. I mean, if you're going to boost household spending by cutting state spending, you're going to boost state spending by taxing households. I mean, killing one off is not a solution. But in regards to long-term economic growth, I think that taxes can be too low or taxes can be too high. I mean, we have public sector needs. We have public sector investments, infrastructure, education. We need to meet those needs. And I think that it's often times overestimated the tax sensitivity of household economic behavior and business economic behavior. The stimulating impacts, you know, even for long-term economic growth prospects of tax cuts are frequently overstated, and so I would have to disagree with the question or the suggestion in general.
Professor, do you have anything to add?
In general, I think, you know, you have to recognize that government does provide valuable and important services, and they have to be financed. But with that said, I think, you know, my perspective is government really is a service provider. And citizens looking at that are paying a certain tax bill for services received. And to the extent that you can provide better services at lower cost, you make the state or the local government, as the case may be, a more attractive place to be. So while it's certainly true that you don't want to necessarily say that any tax cut is good, I think having a well-designed tax code that encourages production and one where you're balancing the productive products of the state, the services that people rely on the state to provide, and funding those, that to the extent that you can cut taxes and still maintain a high level of services, that you certainly make the state more attractive.
Now, this is to both of you. Can you suggest a process or offer advice to the legislature on how to evaluate expenditure requests that are being promoted as a means to enhance the long-term economic development and economy of our state?
Well, I think, you know, my response to that is quite straightforward. The only thing the state really is good at is providing the services that that we typically associate with government. I think to the extent that you're looking at programs that are meant to target specific industries or meant to enhance product, you know, attract firms in a particular way, the evidence is that they're not very successful. There's a long academic literature reviewing these state economic development programs that concludes that they really don't have much of an impact over the long term, and that the states are not very good at picking who the appropriate businesses are to subsidize and so on.
I wouldn't really disagree. With regards to economic development efforts by the state, I consider myself to be just quite old-fashioned. There's infrastructure and educational spending requirements and duties that the state has that I think form the backbone of the contribution that the state makes to our growing economy. And I must admit to sharing some of the concerns that Professor Ruffalo has with inability to pick favorites. I will say that there is a factor in terms of choosing how to spend your money that I think is particularly relevant to our current downturn, and I think plays a role in general spending as well, is that the degree to which we can spend money in areas that attract federal matching dollars, it brings federal dollars into the state, and it's and doubles the impact of our money, and that is a positive thing that should be paid attention to and given priority to, and but it's not an over, that's not necessarily a driving feature of economic development policy, but it is important to pay attention to.
Representative Carlson, did you have another question?
Sure. You were talking, Dr. Ruffalo, about our tax system in Oregon and how the income tax tends not to be the most stable source of taxes for stability. There was some discussion during the last session in the Revenue Committee about a business activity tax, and of course it was very controversial and it wasn't successful. And seemed, if I recall the discussions, economists tend to really like that tax. So I'm wondering, how do you weigh in on that particular type of tax, and are there other tax systems that you would lend more stability to Oregon's government income?
Yeah, I was actually on Representative Shetterly's advisory committee that devised the business activity tax. It's a form of value-added tax. And I think, personally, yes, I think it has a lot of potential as an additional revenue source. I think, as you're probably aware, you know, the traditional triad for governments are property taxes, sales taxes, and income taxes. And it certainly seems that we're not going to have a sales tax in Oregon. The value-added tax, while not a sales tax, in fact, the one that we were looking at was very distinct from a sales tax, is nevertheless has many desirable properties as a revenue source. Basically, the way the business activity tax was structured, it was going to, in effect, tax businesses relative to their activity in the state, with the notion that the activity in the state is some representation of how much the state is providing services to that business, so that the more activity you're conducting in the state, the more tax you would pay, and that would be a form of benefits tax that would be also a fairly stable revenue source, a bit more stable than the income tax, not as stable as the property tax. So yes, I think it has a lot of potential, but clearly there are a lot of people who don't like it, and there's a lot of misunderstanding as to how the tax is structured and what the actual impact would be.
I don't really know. I haven't done enough reading on that particular tax proposal to understand it and enough to comment on. But I will say that regards to stabilizing receipts of the income tax, I think that a rainy day fund can play an important role in that stabilizing process.
So. Do either of you have a state model that currently exists that you would prefer as a more level or fair tax system that is less susceptible to economic downturn than Oregon is?
Are you asking for a specific state to be identified?
Well, I assume that would be easier than saying asking you of a accumulated different tax ideas, what percentage of which would you like to see in Oregon? So I figured we could go look it up after you told us which state it was.
That would presume that we knew the details of all the state tax codes, and I don't think anybody does.
What do we have these guys do?
I can't pick out a particular state. I will say that something that would play into my play into the mix if I was to be sifting through a stack of state tax systems. I would say that I think an additional something that legislators are going to be paying attention to and isn't necessarily high on the list of the factors that many economists would consider when ranking tax systems is the role that equity and fairness play in the tax system. And I think that the degree to which Oregon's income tax is based upon ability to pay is an important and attractive feature despite its instability. So other tax systems that would also put a premium on that principle, I think that I would find myself wanting to pay some attention to.
Representative
Mel. Thank you. I have 14 questions, but I'll just ask two. If you could make a change in the way we run this state government, this large, huge employer, what would you do about the funding, the current service level funding? I mean, right now, would you cut it out and go back and zero-based budget and with performance attached to, you know, an evaluation, or what would you do?
Well, I would look first at, as I said, the core functions of the state. I think, as was mentioned, infrastructure, you know, there are a number of things that we can easily identify where we think that, you know, this is the proper role for government, and I would focus my resources on those areas. I think there are other areas, you know, my favorite is economic development, that I think the state really doesn't have any activity, any particular capability for, and that it's not really an appropriate function for state government. So I would identify. Pardon?
Excuse me.
So I would identify. You know, I would look at things like that, not necessarily in terms of, you know, whether they're, you could have a broad way of evaluating each program, but looking first at what are the core functions of the state government. And then I think you could start evaluating specific programs within each of those core functions and look at the ones that are most effective.
Mr. Thompson?
I think what might fall in my purview as an acceptable role of the state might be a little bit broader than the language that Professor Riflo is using. I think that there's a whole lot of identified public needs that the state can or may opt not to play a role in, but it still would be legitimate to play a role in those areas if it chose. I think I haven't really had the time to think about what the method or the manner in approaching it is, but I think that reviewing the state's current commitments and deciding that if those commitment and determining if those commitments are effective and if they're still up to date is something that should happen on a routine basis. I don't necessarily think that, I mean, being in an economic downturn with budget shortfall gives the impetus to do that because you're looking for ways to save money, but there's other reasons why that might not be the best timing. You might be driven by impulses that are going to, wouldn't necessarily lead you to good policy, but I think that kind of activity, reviewing what the state's doing, is it working, and should we be engaging in this activity, I think is should happen routinely.
Thank you. One of the other questions related to privatization, so I'm just going to take that from your suggestions. I agree with you. I don't think the state should be in the business of, because it certainly isn't developing anything for the economics recovery. So privatization should be an issue. Would you agree?
I think that the issue of privatization, really I would approach it a little more generally. I think that competition is important for improving productivity. To the extent that privatization is an option, I think it can improve competition. There's actually a fairly good experience, I think, in the city of Indianapolis, where they looked at this notion of allowing for competition in the provision of services, and found that public sector workers were, in many cases, came up with the best proposals. That the real issue, I think, is one of allowing for innovation and giving incentives for improved productivity in the public sector, not necessarily directly privatizing, although I certainly think that should be an option that is open if the private sector can do the job more effectively and at you know, higher quality at lower cost.
Thank you for saying that. And if I could, just, Mr. Chair, one of those businesses came from Oregon in Indianapolis, and it's Eagle, and it's the hub for the United States Post Office. And I went back there and helped set it up. And what we found was that, you know, private enterprise could do all the ground handling, the mail sort, much more efficiently and effectively. You know, it's a 10-year contract already going, I guess it'll be going into its next 10-year portion. And we were one of those companies in Indianapolis. Thank you very much for that. Yeah, this is Evergreen in McMinnville, Evergreen National Aviation. Well, this division is called Eagle, Evergreen Aviation Ground Logistics Enterprises. How do you feel about this, Jeff, privatization?
Well, I think that it's something, I think that privatization is probably a very mixed bag. I think there's some things to be concerned about, and I'm not at all prepared to or want to make a blanket condemnation of privatization, but there's some things to be very aware of. In terms of comparing, in terms of engaging in a process of deciding whether or not to privatize or to contract to private providers services, I think my limited review of the literature looking at this topic has suggested that one of the factors that oftentimes gets left out is there's an incomplete understanding of the full range of services that are being provided in the public sector. And so comparing what you're getting and what you're paying, I think that at first blush, there's the potential to think that you're going to be saving a lot, but you're actually buying far less in services from a private from a private contractor. I don't think that there's a fundamental rule that's always going to be the case, but that's something to pay attention to when you make sure you're comparing like services with like services in terms of what you're going to get from a private contractor versus what you're actually getting from your current state delivery service delivery mechanism. And secondly, in terms of from a bargaining perspective, I think there's a danger in the state losing the ability to pull a service back in. Once a service is privatized and contracted out, how much, if the state becomes dependent upon too few or a single private contractor to provide that service and lacks the ability or the hurdles to bring that service back in-house become too high, the terms of the deal and the benefits of the privatization potentially could wither away. So there are some elements of the process of privatization and doing privatization that I think you need to be careful of.
To finish up the end of this, please, Mr. Chair. Do you not think that the state government should be required to purchase for total value? For example, if a private enterprise could provide the services for, you know, health and human services much more efficiently, effectively, and at less cost, do you think we ought to have the right to bid those programs on a continuum basis from the private sector? Whether it's building roads or running prisons.
The evidence is fairly clear that where competition is allowed, that you do get more for your money and it's more efficient. You know, there are certainly some examples of privatization that may have created problems, but I think the overwhelming evidence is that it tends to be positive in terms of the level of service and the cost for government. The other part of it, as I indicate, though, is it's not necessarily privatization per se, but competition that really seems to be the most important thing. A lot of the efficiency issues that we see in state government or local governments in provision of services are really just associated with inertia and with the building up of bureaucratic rules over time, which do not necessarily inherent in government, but they're associated in effect with being a monopoly provider without any incentive to change. And I think the benefit of opening it up to competition is to create incentives for that kind of productivity improvement over time.
And we have no incentive programs for reducing costs or, you know, curbing spending or personnel. But the issues, Mr. Chair, that, you know, that I think somewhere if we were getting, you know, truly getting concerned with would be, you know, what is the function of government? And I would love to hear your definition. I know we're out of time, but I would just love to know that. And then likewise, I would love to know your feeling of regarding mandates. You know, the question is the removal of mandates equivalent to a savings, you know, for education? I mean, there's 12 or 8, 7 written pages of mandates that we've put on the schools running them. And the other one is back to the question we had earlier today. You know, why do we send money to Washington to come back to the state? You know, everybody says, well, it's our, you know, sounds like we're getting matching funds. Well, baloney. You know, that's, if we had the bankers in here again, you know, they just say that's just the carrying charge, you know, for the money that has been over there. But local control, keeping your, you know, your money where it started from would be interesting, and same thing would be in, you know, what is the cost of these mandates? So we were told just recently there are 360 statutorial mandates and constitutional mandates on our businesses that, now, we need to be able to provide those same mandates on state government that are that are required in private enterprise, I mean, to be able to compete. Would you agree effectively?
Let's see if I can
I should have even asked it. I'm done with my questions. I know, I shouldn't have.
I think.
But I just, when you think of those things, you think, you can't. How can private enterprise compete when, you know, we're working under rules and regulations and administrative rules that are much different from what that agency providing that service has to work under? Take ODOT, for example.
Yeah, I think to the extent that, you know, if you're talking about the issue of privatization versus direct public provision, I think that you're correct that, you know, you should operate under the same rules. I also think that your identification of mandates as a potential serious problem is a correct one. I think that it's not typically possible to identify all of the characteristics that a local provider is going to have to meet and basically set up rules that are going to guide their behavior. You know, the notion of mandates, if there are a limited number that are very critical, yes, maybe that's a good thing, but just getting carried away and, as you said, you know, making pages and pages of them obviously impedes the ability to provide services that, you know, in the most efficient manner. In terms of the structure of government, you know, I'm a federalist. I think that, you know, the lowest level of government that can appropriately provide a function should. And that's typically going to be the most efficient way of providing goods and services. Excuse me. I'm not sure that answered your question, but...
Well, when you consider that, you know, 11,000 pages on the new tax code, I mean, this is crazy.
Yeah, Mr. Thomas,
Jeff, I'd love to hear it.
Lot to consider. To
I know, I'm sorry. I
was going to say the professor could take the first 8 questions.
Well, I mean, maybe I'll just go in reverse. I would say that, you know, on the role of government, I mean, I think I don't adhere to any particular philosophy. I think that when the public has needs of a suitable collective response and institution to meet those needs is the state. Where the line of which duties should the state meet and should the state not meet, I think, is going to be in flux over time. With regards to mandates, I think that the number of rules that anybody has to meet, whether it's a private enterprise or a public agency, is going to make the delivery of whatever service they're delivering or the fulfillment of whatever duty they're trying to fulfill more complicated. And I don't know if this is the issue that you were getting at, but I would say that thinking about the public schools is an interesting discussion. I mean, because there is obviously a lively debate in our society at this point in time, is public schools versus private schools, et cetera. And there's an interesting question as to what degree, if indeed private schools are more efficient, I mean, that's up for debate, but to the degree, let's just accept for the discussion now that they are, to what degree are they more proficient because and efficient because they don't have the mountain of rules to adhere to that the public schools do, and if the public could free public schools up from the lengthy list of rules, would public schools become more efficient and likely that they would?
Thank Thank you very much.
Representative Carlson?
Thank you. I just wanted to make a quick comment, and you can choose whether or not you want to respond to it, because it's more a response to what Representative Nelson was talking about. We've sort of morphed into the conversation about the state budgeting process rather than recession, but I think this is a useful discussion, because where we started, if we could put it back into context, is whether a private sector job has more value than a public sector job, whether public sector spending is, whether we need to pay attention to that in the current climate, and given that we're doing budget cuts and so forth. And I think what I've heard you both say is that there is value in public sector spending and public sector jobs, and that it really is our role to determine what the core functions of government are, where dollars are most appropriately spent, there are tax dollars, and what the private sector ought to be doing. And so then you can agree or disagree with whether my rendition is what you said. But the comment I wanted to make back to Representative Nelson, I worked in a state agency where I was involved with budget, in fact, two different state agencies where I was heavily involved with budgets. And this whole issue, and I've heard the discussion before, and I haven't chosen to comment on it, but I would really like to now, around current service level budgeting as opposed to zero-based budgeting, and in essence, what technique we use to analyze whether government is spending its dollars most efficiently. And the comment I would make is that Oregon does neither a pure current service level budgeting, nor does it do zero-based budgeting. And I think that there, at one point in time, zero-based budgeting was looked at as sort of the end-all be-all of how you build a budget. And in practice, what was found, at least from my understanding of what I heard people talk about, is that it can be a very cumbersome process, very time-consuming, where you have to build line upon line, if you will, and that essentially you ended up getting to a very similar place. There weren't that many differences between the type of budgeting we do now and going back to a zero-based budgeting process. And given the time frame that we have to review budgets every 2 years, I'm not sure how practical zero-based budgeting is. The last comment I would make is that the hybrid, if you will, that we have of budgeting, where we do look at caseloads and what it would cost in the next biennium to provide the same level of service that we're doing this biennium, is also overlaid with reduction options that the state is required to provide, and that some of those reduction options actually are taken in the budget process. And I believe that when you have state agencies take a percentage cut, in essence, they make those choices about where they think that they have flexibility and where they ought to move, and that there really is a value in having state agencies make that choice and sort of adjust their services, if you will, to present times. So with that, I will stop, and if you have anything to to that, or whatever you can feel free.
Mr. Chair, I'd just like to recognize Dr. Carlson's information, and I appreciate it, and I understand where she's coming from, and she spent her many years studying an awful lot of these programs. So I do want you to know that I respect that very much. And to say that, the trend is to use all three types of budgeting in state government. You need performance-based, zero-based, and service. I don't think we call it the current service level, but what service level is required to perform the function. So I will just respond, and I do appreciate your brilliance.
I'm going to just give you one last question. A large component of recessions is a lack of consumer confidence, and this recession is likely no different. So what is it that the legislature, or anyone for that matter, could do to improve consumer confidence, thus improving our economy? Go ahead, either one of you.
I'm not sure I would agree with the premise.
Okay.
Certainly consumer confidence has some impact, but I think you have to recognize that, there are other causes of recessions, and that when people have lost jobs and so on, they cut their expenditures because of that, not necessarily because they've lost confidence. They may have some confidence that they're going to get a job back, but they're still constrained. So consumer confidence is certainly one part of the equation and certainly has some impact, but I think you can easily get carried away with how important that is relative to some of the other factors that are affecting expenditures and employment within the economy. With that said, what can the state do about consumer confidence? I would doubt that there's very much that you could do.
I would have to agree, and just to add on a little bit, I think that spending and consumer confidence are related to some degree, but I think it's spending that's the key feature in a recession. And the degree to which investment spending or spending from the business sector is driving a downturn is important, and isn't that linked to consumer confidence at all? To some degree, being the result of previous levels of consumer overconfidence, if you will, overproduction. I mean, we're left with excess capacity, too much ability to produce and not enough dollars to buy it, and also investment spending declining because of events overseas that don't have a whole lot to do with consumer confidence at home. So I'm also skeptical of the linkage. It's not an unimportant factor, but what I think maybe the answer to the question is one of psychology and communication with the public rather than actual policy changes. But I wouldn't know, and I would doubt if it could do much as well.
But thank you, panelists, and thank you, members.
Mr. Chair, before you say it's over.
It is over.
But in our economy and situation of a recession, shouldn't we ask the question, shouldn't there be a moratorium on spending? Shouldn't there be a hold on new programs? I mean, just the practicality of good economic principles. I mean, shouldn't that question be asked? It's kind of like asking, would the sales tax be a good idea and take away the income and property tax? But I won't even get into that one. But wouldn't it be very, very good to just know from two economists that, you know, shouldn't, in a recessionary period, should there be a moratorium on state spending and a hold on the development and implementation of new programs?
Well, I think they've answered that to a degree. Mr. Thompson indicated that a significant cut in state spending would be...
But is state spending or public spending?
Well,
both. I mean, it might even be desirable for the federal government into deficit spending to be an economic stimulus. So I wouldn't be in agreement with your proposition.
They're so intertwined, I think it's very difficult to separate.
But it sounds more like...
Well, that 65,000 people, what is it, 65 maybe times four, individuals versus the rest of the state.
We have to end.
let's have a debate.
And I'm going to request...
You are great. Chris, what's his name?
I don't know.
On TV, what's that guy's name?
Matthews.
Matthews. You're Mr. Chair, you've been a great Chris Matthews.
Thank you so much. And I would request that both gentlemen provide you with their email address so you can continue your dialogue.
Oh, I would be so thrilled.
Questions, but thank you very much. We appreciate it. And if there's nothing else for the good of the order, the committee is adjourned.
You know, I think it'd be so good to have programs like this where you brought in...